Are you a big brain of the beautiful game? Prove it with the great new app that'll test your football knowledge to the limit. Name That Player. Download the Name That Player app today and race against the clock to identify the Premier League players purely from a list of the clubs they've played for. Put your football knowledge to the ultimate test with the Name That Player app. Available right now for iOS and Android from the App Store and Google Play. Name That Player. Can you beat the best?
Shoot the defence, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
That should be a club legend. It's just totally disrespectful. And like I say, it's just a lack of respect, lack of class. And I hope they get relegated and liquidated.
Jan, do you want to do that voice of your barber so we can guess which nationality he is?
Are you ready?
Sounds like a really bad porno, mate.
And the fact that we had now taken our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable. And with very young players, so it was...
Yeah, but I've seen misses, like, you
but
know...
But that wasn't a miss.
Misses, what he misses, he stopped his mate from scoring it.
I'm your host, Stel, and I'm joined on the line by former Queen's Park Rangers and England international David Bardsley. David, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for agreeing to come on. How is life treating you at the moment?
Yeah, very good. The last 5 or 6 years have been in the QPR, USA, mm-hmm. and that's been, you know, it's been going really, really well, kind of. You know, coming to a heads up on that at this moment. You know, we've had great success. 29 national team players come out of the program.
Wow.
And to date, 17 of our, you know, players that have come through the program have all moved on to professional soccer now. And the last one's just joined a professional club in Mexico, FC Mariah. So it's been really good. And, you know, the success we've had with the branding of, you know, the wearing the QPR stuff and traveling pretty much on the wide regions of America has taken the academy to lots of good places, and it's been very fortunate because the players have done extremely well with the people that have followed the program, have continued to watch the players. So it's pretty incredible for a small program to have 17 odd players go pro. And you know, I think two or three more will probably move into that field as well by the time it moves along.
Well, how does the scholarship work? Does that apply to your academy?
Well, I mean, obviously, as many people know, or many people may not know, in Europe, you know, America's all about, you know, developing players at club level for them to move into college. Mm-hmm. And obviously from college, they spend 4 years playing there from the age of 18 to 22. And then hopefully, you know, these boys get selected to go on the Major League Soccer draft. And then, you know, maybe one of them is picked, two of them is picked, you know, so that the Major League Soccer clubs pick up the odd player that comes out of college on the draft each year. We've had draft players, we've had 5 or 6 different draft players that have left our academy, gone to college, done the 4 years, come out, and then gone on. But we've kind of gone in between that now. We've had players go straight from the academy straight to the professional club. So, you know, some of the boys that don't want to do the 4 years at college, you know, had to work a lot harder to get the possible rewards at the age of 19, you know, 19 and a half, and sign, you know, professional contracts. So, you know, with a lot of incredibly, you know, well-disciplined and hard coaching, and you know, people kind of don't give it a lot of credit over here, I don't think, but the standard of play, you know, in our academy, we've got all kinds of players, French players, American players, German players, English players, so that the thing is, you know, these boys stay 3, 4, 5 years with us, and obviously, you know, the hope is that we can move them off into the professional game. But as I say, you know, it's kind of coming to the last, you know, 5 or 6 months now for me, because I'm obviously looking for different avenues to move on now, and I've really enjoyed what we've done with the QPR thing over here. But it's time to move on into a different challenge, and you know, the QPR thing for me, we did it over here because, you know, one would argue the love of the club kind of thing. But the fact is, by the branding that we've put over here, you know, that's where the boys have got all the success from, pretty much.
Right. Well, to be honest, I mean, if you look at what you're doing at QPR and the academy in America, it's a lot different to the opportunities that you had. In fact, back when you first started as a footballer, there weren't that many opportunities. And I take it that you were born in Blackpool, but you ended up playing for Coventry City at schoolboy level. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I was with Coventry all through my, you know, the school, you know, it's the school education, the schoolboy forms, that kind of thing. So I was with them for like 5 or 6 years, and, you know, you travel down there in the summer, spend a week, go back. And then pretty much when I left school, Coventry City kind of went, bang, we're not going to sign you, you're out. And they signed another guy that I knew, a guy called Mick McGinty at the time. He was a good lad, he was a left back, but they signed him instead of me, and, you know, everybody has different opinions. 2 days later, I got a phone call from Blackpool, so I went there, and it kind of transitioned from that moment. But whilst Mick kind of, when they signed him at Coventry, he kind of, like, transitioned out of the game after, like, 2 years. So, you know, one would always argue when I went back there with QPR to play games, I always wanted to win more than any other club in the show. They made a mistake, but, you know, that's football, isn't it?
Yep, absolutely. So, well, you signed for Blackpool as an apprentice, and then you turned pro in 1982. Now, Watford was your next destination, where you played under Graham Taylor. What was it like playing for him, and did the atmosphere at the club change much when Dave Bassett took over?
Well, I've got to laugh about that. I mean, when I went to Watford, it was, you know, there was a group of really great people there, you know, John Barnes, Luther Blissett, and a lot of older pros coming to the end, you know, George Riley. Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing is, the first year we made the FA Cup final.
Right.
You know, so and we played against Everton, so it was really great. But, yeah, the thing is, I think that there was between what Graham had accomplished at Watford, which was kind of staggering, really. Mm-hmm. I think although Wimbledon went down a similar path, I think that when Dave came into Watford, I mean, let's put it like this: I didn't last very long.
Right.
I didn't like what I saw and the things that had been said. So, you know, fortunately for me, I was off to Oxford, you know, 3 or 4 weeks into that reign, but. Yeah, absolutely. It all changed. You know, I heard rumours that even the manager's door was changed, taken off its hinges, and a new one put on because, you know, people are. Yeah, I mean, there was. I think there was an air of, you know, I'm going to go one better here than Graham's gone, and I don't think anybody could have accomplished that at the time. I don't think anybody really has. You know, so, yeah, there was definitely a different attitude because there was a number of Wimbledon players that came in and pretty much a lot of people were shifted out, let's put it like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's football and you just get on with it. But, yeah, absolutely, there was a total difference.
But was it more of a football reason why you left than anything? Because, you know, let's say Harry Bassett had a way of playing the game, which these days it wouldn't work. It would be frowned upon. I half expected you to be asked to be lumping the ball forward.
Well, I think when, you know, when we played with Graham, you know, the as they call it, the channel ball, if you remember that saying, you know, knock it in the channel, people are going to get on the end of it. You know, that was how Watford played for a long time, so it wasn't dissimilar, but we did have better technical players, you know, than Wimbledon had at the time. So we did kind of mix it up a little bit. We were fortunate, you know, with some of the great young players we had come to the program at the time. So, no, it wasn't really a football reason, you know. It was just that, you know, for me, even though I was still really young, I used to listen to some of the things that I wanted you to do in training, and for me it was like, you know, can't swear or anything like that, but, you know, what are you going on about, you know, this isn't for me, mate, I've got to get out of here. And there was two or three of us that were in that boat, and, you know, everybody moves on. And,
absolutely, you know, absolutely.
But, I didn't want to leave Watford, but...
So you ended up at Oxford United. I believe, was it Murray Sevens that signed you? But he wasn't...
Morris, yeah.
Yeah, but he wasn't there long before Mark Lawrence and then Brian Houghton took charge. Now, which one of the three do you think you learned the most from?
Well, I mean, obviously Brian Houghton.
Right.
I mean, Brian's... you know, look, there's a lot of great people in the game. You know, Morris Evans was more of a gentleman and a manager and a, you know, kind of a general manager type thing. He wasn't really a coach or to the stage where he'd pass that on to, you know, Ray Graydon was there at the time, who was a great player for Aston Villa, if you remember him. Mm-hmm. And people didn't like Ray at all, but I thought he was just a superb coach.
Right.
So anyway, they kind of moved on and then Brian came in with Mark Lawrence, and then, you know, Loro didn't last long. He was out the door, you know, within 20 minutes. It wasn't for him, this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can't really remember exactly what happened, but, you know, I guess if you're Mark, you cannot withstand the kind of mistakes that players at Oxford can make, if that makes sense. Because when he's been playing around Liverpool players all his career, when you come down to manage at that level, even though we were still in the top division at the time, the errors that were going on and the mistakes were really hard for him to take. So whatever happened, he moved on for whatever reason. And I think it may have had something to do with Dean Saunders going to Liverpool, and they didn't want to sell him at the time. And Mark ended up moving on soon after that because I think there was a bit of an argument. So, but Mark was a great guy, a great player, somebody... you know, to look up to, and it's always difficult because, he, in that era, I was playing against Mark Lawrence when I was at Watford, so, you know, it was like, it was great to be now on the other side of it, being coached by these people that you were playing against before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really unusual to have those kind of experiences because you learn different things, and you learn good things and you learn bad things.
That's right.
Well, you know.
I find it interesting that you mentioned Dean Saunders going to Liverpool may have been the reason for Lawrence's exit, because wasn't John Aldridge at Oxford the year before you signed for them, and then he ended up at Liverpool?
Yeah. Well, yeah, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm thinking Liverpool, but now I'm thinking, did Dean actually go to Derby? I think he might have gone to Derby,
wouldn't it? Yeah.
He went to Liverpool. Yeah, Derby County, yeah. I'm sorry, I missed that question. What was that?
No, because it was John Aldridge that was at Oxford the year before. So I take it maybe Lawrenson was a bit, I don't know, upset that he'd be losing a striker every summer. Kind of how, you know, it was Southampton at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, John wasn't wasn't at Oxford when John was there. That was kind of way before me. The manager brought me in to replace... I think one of the great right backs, Dave Langan, I think,
okay.
At the time, he was the fantastic right back, and he was kind of like the last player from that John Aldridge team. And, you know, kind of everybody had moved on. There was a lot of younger players coming through. Gary Briggs was still there, people like that. And Billy Whitehurst, if you remember that name.
Okay.
Big centre forward. And yeah, God, yeah. How you doing, Bill? I'm run off. Yeah, he was. That was a really interesting time. And obviously, the upsetting news for I think what his name was now. I can't remember what his name was. It's terrible that I can't remember. Tommy Caton, of course, passed away.
Okay.
When he had the accident at Oxford, so, and he was a great player as well. But I played at Oxford with Colin Greenall, who was my teammate at Blackpool as well. So it was weird we came back to play together again at that stage. But that was I really enjoyed that. And you know, wherever I go, I never want to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the problem. It's always been the problem with me, because you don't really just go for you kind of get into somewhere and you feel you don't want to go. And you know, the QPR thing was just something out of the blue, really.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, as you mentioned, it was a completely out of the blue. Trevor Francis signed you in 89. Do you remember the chain of events which actually led to your move at QPR?
Yeah, I mean, probably most go against the rules. You know, the phone calls and all those things that used to happen in those days. But, I didn't have an agent or anything like that at that time, as far as I can think back. But I kind of come off the back of a knee injury, and I'd been out for like 3 or 4 months, and got back into it, and then all of a sudden, QPR were looking for a right back, and it was pleasing. I got picked that's like the best right back in that division,
right.
And they had those awards, so that was good. And to go to QPR down the road, and then I found it really difficult to settle in at first because I didn't want to play. I'm not a right winger. I didn't really want to play there. I didn't really want to play there at Watford either.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just fortunate, I guess, that some injuries at QPR and, that I don't think the fans took to me at all, which, I found it really difficult when I used to drive away from the games and, whether I was playing or I wasn't playing on that in that wide position. I hated it. But it was... found it really difficult because you feel you let people down, the fans down, and you kind of got to go away and think, you got to come back a different person the following week and try to, win them over.
Yeah.
And I think, it took about 8 months to do that, and I ended up getting a chance to play right back. I think against Millwall it was the first game when somebody got injured and I dropped back, and I was very fortunate because I had a reasonable game, and then from then I really didn't miss a game for a long time in that position until I got ill or injured or something happened. So, you just needed that one game to show what you can do in that position.
Yeah. Well, Trevor Francis was sacked 2 months into your spell at QPR, and is replaced by the legend that's Don Howe. Now, I've heard a lot of positive things about Don, especially his man management techniques. What was it like playing under him?
I love Don. I mean, again, you become accustomed to being around people, and one would argue is possibly one of the best coaches I've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
in coaching capacity. That Don was on the other side of 50, I think, at that time. And, we'd be on the training field. And I think Roy Wegley joined the club at the time, and, he didn't know what a channel room was. So you got Don stood on the halfway line, running in the corner like a steam train. And he's like, you have a heart attack in a minute. It's like, God. It was so funny. We went like, if my memory's correct, we had a run of like 24 unbeaten games under Don Howe.
Wow.
And we had an incredible season. We were beating Liverpool 3-1 at Anfield. We were close not to knock them out of the FA Cup, took them to a replay. And Don knows the game, but he was a coach, not a manager really.
Mm-hmm. Was that the year?
Yeah, he was a superb man.
Was that the year where you beat United 4-1 on New Year's Day?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I don't know who was in charge, whether it was Jerry or Don. I can't remember. I can remember the game, of course, but I can't remember who was in charge at that moment in time. I think it was Jerry. Possibly.
Okay. Fair enough.
Because Ray. Maybe. I just can't remember back. That's a really good question. That's kind of me thinking now, because I normally know most things about QPR in that era. But
do you know, it was Jerry, actually, now you mentioned it, because Jerry Francis took over in 91, didn't he? I think the game was in 92, because I think, if correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was actually one of the last league games that ITV showed live. And then I think that's when he went to Sky and everything. So yeah, I think I'm pretty sure it was 92.
Actually. Yeah, it could be.
Pretty sure it was 92. Yeah, but speaking of Jerry Francis, you know, from what I hear and from what I've read in recent interviews, you have a lot of admiration for Jerry. What was it like with Jerry Francis at the helm?
With Jerry, I first met Jerry in the players' bar at Arsenal when we drew a game. I think at the time, you know, he wasn't manager then, but he was coming in, of course. So I met him in the players' bar and just said hi. And I think he just kind of took over a couple of weeks ago. But you know, Jerry's that kind of person, you know, who he's just really straight with you. And you're either going to do it or you're not going to do certain things. And you know, one might say old school, really good coach, but you know, I think the coaching was more lined up. They're going to put a session on for you, and they're going to just expect you to do it. It wasn't so, you know, technical, but that group we had at the time, you know, you could put a session on and the players would be out there very long. Or, you know, we did a lot of hard running sessions with Jerry and, you know, a lot of box to box stuff. But he was just a great person to work for because, you know, I like people who are just going to be straight, say it the way it is, and you've got to come back a better person the next day or the next weekend. And that's what I believe football's all about. Unfortunately, I think that's changed at the moment because I don't think the modern players can handle getting hammered by their manager or the fans, and they, you know, they want to win something. I mean, that's just an opinion, you know, maybe a comical opinion, but players don't really take too well to getting hammered by their managers these days, or the truth, if you know what I mean. But he was a good guy, and you know, we had a lot of great success with him. And you know, we do more technical training in this academy, well, we do, than I ever did with Jerry. But there was a thing, you know, you're playing for this guy, a QPR, a man through and through. And I think that's what the thing with the players here, they all knew Jerry's background, and he was not, if you weren't going to do it, there would be problems, if that makes sense.
Right.
And it would be sorted out the old-fashioned way. And, you know, I think, yeah, I mean, that's, you laugh about it, but I mean, it's like, you know, we had the players that could give it and take it, and we always came back the next day better players, and that's why we had such an amazing, camaraderie type of thing in that team. And a lot of it down to Jerry, you know, he brought lots of different people in. You know, Gary Penrice, great, magnificent buys. Ian Holloway, superb. You know, Devon White, you know, these kind of players that Jerry could just get a great performance of. And, you know, some would ask questions. Some would say, is David really a Premier League player? He just come from Oxford type of thing. You know, because I don't think the players looked at themselves as heroes or anything like that. We were just QPR players.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, you got to turn it in. You got to turn it in for the fans, and that was the most important thing. And I think for the fans, we had a lot of Mickey takers, and but once we stepped over that line, like, you know, the boys really wanted to play.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, look, when you've got players like, you know, Ian Holloway and I assume Rufus Brevitt and Danny Maddix were jokers, it wouldn't surprise me that you had that camaraderie. But, you know, a lot of people don't seem to realise that QPR came fifth that season. So obviously the old-fashioned way worked. I mean, you came above Liverpool and Tottenham and Man City and Arsenal that season, which is incredible, absolutely incredible. And you yourself were voted in the team of the year, right back.
Yeah, I think we finished top Premier League club in London the first 3 years out of my members, some people would argue, looking at the group of players we had and where we came from, you know, that was no problem, you know, coming in. But we just became, nobody wanted to play us, especially at home, and, you know, QPR got away from home, we could beat Liverpool and we could beat United. It's not an issue. We just got to perform, and if we didn't, you know, we let ourselves down. It wasn't that we got hammered. We never got hammered by anybody in that, you know, 4 or 5 years. Yeah, we might have had the odd bad get, it upsets them, you know, kind of stuff. But, you know, we had kind of a lethal group of players on and off the field. You know, me and a Big Macca rooming together. You know, me and Macca got up to all kinds of, because at that time, the fans were part of the, like Macca's mates, like at the end of the season, for example, 1 year. And I was just looking at it this morning. Me and Macca used to take the mickey out of everybody, and there was all kinds of jokes and tricks and all stuff, and we were pretty bad. So at the end of one season, Macca got all his mates in the players' bar to come down, and they chained me up in this massive ball and chain. So it was like freezing cold. I think it was after the last game of the season against Crystal Palace.
Right.
And then they turned all the lights off. They all got showered, went up to the players' bar, and I was sat down there, freezing my arse off with this massive ball and chain. I couldn't even move anywhere. So the following year, it was Macca's turn, so all got all my mates down, all down, handcuffed Macca up to the shower, give him his cigarette, let him have a smoke. And then, like, the apprentices would come in and they were throwing huge buckets of water all over him every time he threw a cigarette. even the police were in there borrowing us the handcuffs and all kinds of stuff. It was like, you know, in those days, it was like, I mean, listen, Mr. Thompson had come down the training ground, or even Jerry, and it's like, you know, you get Macca, fill a bucket of water up and put it on top of the door. You know, when he walks in, leave it half open, and like this, and we'd be all down the other end of the corridor, all the players waiting for that can to hit the floor, that bucket. And you, no, there was all kind of great stuff. And, you know, it was a great family club, and the fans were just part of everything we did.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm not, you know, Les will remember all that stuff, and you know, Les was right in there as well, and you know, so it was good time, and you know, just want to hope that QPR can come back in a different manner, you know, and you know, get us back to where we really need to be, which is, you know, do whatever you want, but when you get over that white line, you got to play for QPR, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, things changed at the club. Jerry Francis was replaced with Ray Wilkins, then Stuart Houston came in with Bruce Rioch. They didn't last longer than two seasons before being sacked. Now, John Hollins had a brief stint at the helm before Ray Harford came in. It appears that once Jerry Francis had gone, the club lost what the music industry did when James Brown passed, and that's a lot of soul. Francis epitomised everything that was QPR, so do you think it would have been difficult for anyone to come in and do a job, because ultimately Jerry was Mr. QPR?
That's a good question. You know, Les moved on, Andy went, and Big Macca had gone. I was injured nearly for 2 years, 96 to, you know, virtually 90. I was out for 2 years nearly with my Achilles, and what I was seeing, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing, basically, because, if you got a training session and, you know, players would be used, if it's cold and if the snow's been there or whatever, some players want to train in their tracksuit bottoms or their bobble hat and their gloves. Well, you know, obviously, I have a lot of respect for Bruce and Stuart, but they didn't allow those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing is, you know, the great young players we had coming through, like Imps was there, Sinclair was there still, Diccio was there. They drove them all out of the club because the players, they weren't used to that sergeant major type of thing.
Right.
And, you know, don't get me wrong, you know, Bruce and Stuart were nice, never did anything wrong to me, but then again, I was in the gym all the time, so it was a difficult time for me, but I was seeing the players, and the players that were coming in. I mean, you know, we'd spent 5 years, you know, giving most of these players a good hammering, and then all coming into the club, and some of the people that came in didn't come in to play for QPR.
Mm.
It is what it is. and there was a lot of weird agents knocking around the training ground all the time, and it became a bit of a joke, to be honest. Mm. You know, some of the people that did come into the club, I don't think they really ever got over that, you know, to be honest.
Right.
And I don't know whether they are now.
Right. Well, you know, there's a big transition at the club. I mean, you made captain at one point, weren't you? And you got players like Simon Barker that was still there, Kevin Gallen, Trevor Sinclair was a fantastic footballer at QPR, and someone like Mark Hateley. I mean, what was it like having him at the club? Because we know how well he did at Monaco and Rangers.
Oh, Mark came off the back of that little injury he had, but he didn't seem to get over that at Rangers. And, you know, it was unfortunate because they left some kind of piece of the knife left in his foot or something.
Yeah, I heard.
A little bit of the blade, and there was big issues. But, yeah, I mean, listen, I used to watch Mark Hateley on the telly, and you know, I remember that game that he played in against Leeds in the Champions League or European Cup or something like that, and he ran from the halfway line and scored that goal at Elland Road. And, you know, you're talking about these guys are just amazing. I mean, Mark Hayden was at Coventry, and I was there, of course, but I was a schoolboy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're talking about a guy, one of the best headers of the ball ever. And then, obviously, Les comes along and matches that, if not betters it. But, yeah, I mean, you know, listen, when Ray came to the club, I mean, for me, it was like, this is just amazing, you know, to be around this person. I mean, I used to say to the doctor, you know, I used to go to the doctors and say, listen, you've got to get in fit. Is he going to be fit? You know, we can't play with him and blah, 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 blah. It was like, you know, the kind of players are kind of a big liking for each other at that moment in time. But,
right.
You know, playing with people like Ray Wilkins was like, you could just make a forward run and the ball would just appear.
Mm-hmm.
And the only person that's ever been able to match Ray, in my opinion, is obviously Andrea Pirlo.
Right.
I don't know another midfield player that has that weight of pass, that vision, and you know, Ray was a magnificent player. Yeah, and obviously, you know, there was a number of people that came and went, but it was just interesting. But yeah, I think the Stuart, who, and then onto Mr. Harford. Unfortunate what happened to Mr. Harford in the end, of course, but you know, Ray wasn't a QPR manager, with the greatest respect in the world, and you just because you have a great reputation somewhere else, it doesn't mean to say that you're going to come into a club and do the same thing. And as you can see what happened. It didn't. It was just, you know, from the on, I don't think you are many, many, many years with the different decisions they made. And then Holly came back in, of course, and tidied it up for a little bit.
Mm. Well, they brought in Vinnie Jones and Neil Ruddock. Yeah, I was about to ask you what you made of it, but yeah, I think that says it all, really.
But I mean, you know, it's difficult to say what one really wants to say or feels, but you know, as I said, I think the club lost direction.
Mm-hmm.
of what was going on, and then got relegated into the division below, and they're the right kind of players to get us out. And that's just a football opinion. You know, everybody has an opinion on what's right and what's wrong. I mean, when John O'Hurley was there, when I had my injury, the club made me assistant to John Hollins. You know, so obviously I was kind of like a coach come assistant manager at that time, you know, for maybe 6 months, and then I obviously went back into playing again when I got fit again. But I really enjoyed working with John Hollins, and for me, John Hollins should have stayed because they had a really nice run of games in the division below, unbeaten, and then when Holly left, John Hollins left, they started to lose again. You know, too many changes isn't good.
Mm. Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Graham Taylor selected you twice for the national team, once against Spain in 1992, and then Poland in Katowice a year later. Now, that game in Poland, Was that the most intense and intimidating ground you've ever played in? Because I remember how crazy the Polish fans went when they took the lead, and the deafening silence when Ian Wright levelled at the end.
Yeah, I mean, before the game, you know, it was a weird environment because there was fires on the terrace and there was bottles being thrown all over the place, and it didn't really bother me. I find it quite stupid, to be honest, but, you know, you don't really bother about what they're doing. But, you know, for me, it was a very reasonable run of games in the Premier League that year, and for me, that was one of my best games of the year. I didn't really look at it that it's for QPR or for England. As a personal game, a performance, I thought I had a really good game, and I was pleased that Ben Hoddle had felt in his pre-game interview that I was possibly one of the best players on the field. So I was really pleased for Glenn to say something like that, and obviously. But there was in one instance, I can't remember what happened, but there was I played a simple square ball to Des Walker at the time, you know, and Des was a fantastic defender and great player, but it took him 10 minutes to control the ball, and they went through and scored, and
yeah,
so I kind of got blamed for that, and you know, I phoned Frank Sidwell after the game and the next day, and I said, you know, Frank, I don't think there's anything wrong with the ball. There was nobody within 50 yards of Des Walker when I played in that ball. In any modern game today, if you're playing four at the back or three at the back, look how many times the ball goes around the back of the back four.
Yeah,
it's not my fault. He couldn't control the ball. But yes, it was one of, it was I was really pleased with that performance. I had the game. He did, but you know, I've never watched it since I played in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like watching games or, you know, been back in the past, but I recollect the game to this very moment now, and I thought I did reasonably well. The first game against Spain, I got injured, so, you know, I came on and I ruptured all my ankle ligaments, you know, within 20 minutes, and then I had to wait 6 months to get back in again. And, you know, the funny thing is, because Graham was my manager at Watford, you know, I thought I was as good as anybody else at that moment in time. And you know, would maybe argue now that at the time I didn't really look at it like that because QPR, I'm coming back to QPR, so what bigger moment to come from if you drop from playing for England and to come back to play for the best club anyway, so
yeah.
What the hell, I'm just going to get on with it with my club, and you know, it's my boss and anything, and that's the way I kind of looked at it, but maybe that's why I didn't play for England that much, but because I used to say those kind of things, and you've got to be honest and say what you feel, you know, a lot of people don't do that, that was the end of that. I was in lots of different stuff, of course, but I didn't really go on playing, and Graham got fired after that Norway game. I think it was Norway where they lost. And, you know, I was used to playing with Don Howe. Like, you know, we had that five at the back system. Graham wanted to play it, and he chose to play Dicko instead, Lee Dixon.
Right.
It didn't kind of work out too well because three goals came from that area, or two goals came from that area, so it didn't kind of work out too good. But, you know, No regrets on anything for me.
Well, I've got a question actually about the England national team. It's just literally just sprung in my head. You hear it especially a lot more these days. Why didn't Graham Taylor pick the Arsenal back five, should I say? Why do you think he didn't pick them? Because obviously they were solid back under George Graham. Do you think there was a reason why he chose not to play him? Did he feel that people like Des Walker were better than the likes of Tony Adams and possibly Steve Bould?
I think that's a great question and a gen question that many people would ask about lots of different things. Mm-hmm. Because you know, if you look at all England squads, 99% of the players come from the top four or five clubs.
Yeah,
and I think in Graham's case, Graham's era, he picked too many of those people and played too many of them that were not performing well, let alone club level and international level, weren't playing well at all. I mean, when I first got in that squad, and you know, there was some, look, there was your Gascoigne, your David Platts, your Inters, your Mark Wright, Ian Wright, you know, there was Chris Woods. I mean, you're talking about great players, but you know, if you actually look at the performances on the field, they were terrible. We were not playing well at that moment in time. Yet the players never said anything. They always let Graham take. You know, I'm not into that. You know, it's like if I played bad at QPR, it's not Jerry's fault I played bad. It's my fault. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, when you manage England, you know, you've got to stand out and say, listen, I had a nightmare. But you don't get a lot of players saying it now. They don't want to say it. As a matter of fact, you don't get a lot of players saying that ever. There's just a handful of people I knew probably at QPR that would just come out and say, yeah, we've had a nightmare. It's nobody else's fault.
Yeah.
You make up for that. But, I mean, to be around those players, you know, coming, you know, I came from Blackpool, remember? So to be around the Gascoigne and your Inces and, you know, David Platts, Chris Woods, world-class players at that moment in time. But they weren't really doing it for their country. And I think, you know, they're honest with themselves. I think they'd admit that as well.
Yeah. I mean, I remember Euro 92 when he called up players like Keith Curl. And I think Tony DiRigo was there because he was at the regular slot at left back. Then Neil Webb and Alan Smith, they weren't really doing anything at international level, which confused me as to why they were being continually called up.
Well, Tony played for England against Poland as well with myself, and obviously he was used to playing, you know, that blitz at five at the back sometimes, and he got dropped and I got dropped. And Graham chose to play two people that had played that system.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they came unstuck. But yeah, some of those, which you mentioned, yeah, you Neil Webb like that. Solid, magnificent club players, and argumentatively needed much longer in the international setup to prove themselves.
Yeah.
Graham picked a lot of different people, and sometimes just from passion, to be like, I remember Steve Bull.
Yep.
Got a chance to play for Wolves, and you know, it's like I was doing London Talk Sport, you know, do that now and again, and the guys asked me a question about Charlie, of course, at QPR, and it's like, if he comes into the England squad, do you think he should play, and blah, 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 blah. Well, the thing is, you know, maybe one would argue he deserves a chance to play in a friendly game if you're going to bring him into the squad. You got to play him, because if he's not playing in one of those training games we've had recently against lesser countries, if that's what you want to say, and then he doesn't make it into the Euros next year, what does that actually say about, you know, himself?
Yeah.
You're going to look at himself and think, I'm going to be good for friendly games. I mean, you, if you're going to bring people in, you've got to give them a chance and play them.
Mm.
Otherwise, I don't see the point of ruining somebody's confidence. Well, players may think differently. I don't really know, but, you know, that's what I would think anyway.
That's a fair point. That's a very fair point. The thing is, I'm sure a lot of people ask you if you're disappointed that you didn't get more than two caps, but let's be honest. I mean, you had players like Paul Parker, I think Lee Dixon, Gary Stevens, yourself and Earl Barrett, and you're all vying for that one spot. So it does make it difficult when you've got like a saturated position.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people got to, you know, look at it from a wide picture, and I guess you can argue. One would argue, and I would say that, you know, if the best players from the top clubs are being picked all the time for England, for example, which is history, of course, historical, well, QPR were top London club for 3 years on the trot, and we only ever had two players in the England squad. So there's something not right there, if you understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
You know, so we were above those teams, like at Arsenal's, but those players are still getting picked. And you know, when you look at some of the left backs that have played for England, and you're talking about Clive Wilson, I mean, Willow was the best. I'm sure he's sick of hearing it, but I mean, without doubt, the best left back that I've seen or played with, technically, distribution, pace, maybe not always get a defending right, but then again, who does?
Yeah.
So, you know, you're talking about a magnificent player that never played, so I can't really argue with two caps. And, you know, I did what I set out to accomplish. I didn't realise I'd only get two caps after getting one. But that's just the way it goes, and there's not a lot you can do about it. You just got to know that you made it with at that level to play for your country with so many other great fullbacks. Mm. Now, whether I agree that those players are better than me, it is a different story. And, you know, you can't have a conversation about that on the radio.
Of course.
You know?
Of course. I don't blame you. I don't blame you for sitting on that fence. Well, look, you had a persistent groin problem which effectively ended your career as a player, but you've since embarked on a lot of different projects, namely the QPR Academy, which you mentioned earlier, and working with Ajax. Now, with all the experience that you have playing at the highest level in England, when you went to Ajax and you saw how it worked there, were you surprised with what you saw?
When I got asked to do this thing in 2004 with a friend of mine over here, and it was a link between obviously Ajax Amsterdam, and they were going to set up this thing in America called Ajax America. And you know, what I learned out of it was the travels to obviously Ajax Amsterdam, you know, four or five times a year, and looking at what I'd never seen before, basically.
Right.
And I think that I personally think that, you know, moving away and seeing the way it is there, and also the things that I've seen here, I've learned so much more about the game than I ever knew. And was it the right decision to do that? I don't really know, because obviously, you know, sometimes when your name's out of the picture, it's harder to break back in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was just really looking to transition back in. But the Ajax thing taught me so many things that if I hadn't have gone there, I wouldn't know today. You know, the training standards are incredibly high. And that's kind of the way I based, you know, when obviously when Ajax America closed down and they went to concentrate on Ajax Africa, then obviously I set this QPR Academy up, but I set it up with no American player here who you cannot come into this program if you want to do it properly and mess around. It's 5 days a week. We're going to go right through. There's only 3 weeks off the entire year in, year out. You know, and I only had like 4 or 5 weeks off in nearly 7 years. And, you know, we're going to go out the right way. We're going to travel. We're going to play against the best teams. We're going to develop. We're going to put you up against the best players. We're going to go to Dallas Cup every single year. We're going to have Di Milan over here, Man United, Man City, Liverpool, Everton. And, you know, for the likes of my players to get the chance to play against the U19 Milk Cup winners from Man City, for example,
yeah.
And, you know, in training games and draw 0-0, I have to ask a question and say, if that was the Milk Cup winners in England, then what is the standard of my U19 players at this moment here? And we only had two English players in the team, the rest of them Americans.
Right.
So, you know, it's not about standards, but I think people don't give the credit that they should for the players that are over here. And you know, my players that have gone on to play professional sport, any one of them could have gone back and played in England.
Mm-hmm.
But that has to be somebody who's asking questions about what they're doing. And, you know, my disappointment would be my disappointment. and with all the work that we've done here. And you know, the funny thing is, the players that I have taken back to England, they haven't been to QPR, and that hurts me more than anything. And, you know, and there's nothing you can do about it, because if people just don't show the interest, then there's not a lot you can do.
Mm. So would you say that's probably...
You know, so,
would you say that's one of the reasons why our national team hasn't thrived then? Because at that level, at grassroots level, there is a lack of interest, regardless of every time the national team fails and they say, oh, we need to go back to grassroots. Are teams doing enough?
Well, let me put it like this. The U17 England national team came over before Christmas last year. They played down in IMG Academies, and they played the US men's U18 national team and lost 3-1.
Right.
We played them in a game and drew 0-0 with our U18s. Now, you know, my twins play for the U18s, or there's a number of other English players that play in there. Most of that group now have gone off to college. The other boys signed for the club in Mexico. Now, my argument would be, what I'm saying is, my argument would be, if the U17 national team from England come over here and lose 3-1, and we go to Dallas Cup, and we take a group of players there that they shouldn't have gone to Dallas Cup. It's not the strongest group we've ever taken there at that moment in time. But when we come back, we get a chance to play the U18 team and for 0-0. Now, there is a problem. Does it make sense to you what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So if England are losing 3-1 and we're drawing 0-0 and we're wearing a QPR a black and white away kit, and what I'm saying is, I think there was somewhere where I think my agent put some little tweets out about the chairman should come over and watch the game. What magnificent branding can you have, mm-hmm, QPR playing the men's national IMG Academy team based out of IMG, I guess. So, but there was just no pull on that string. So we went there and we drew 0-0. And you got to ask questions. I mean, I watched the game. I went down to watch the England team play Christmas last year, and I thought they were very basic. I know most of the American boys at the national team, and you know, one would argue that they've all gone off to play B1 now, or for the men's U20s in this recent competition.
Yeah.
But they're not what I'm saying, Championship or Premier League style players. They're not even Major League Soccer standard players.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an issue, really, you know. So, and I think, you know, I can't do it in many different ways. And that would be my only disappointment, that we've done what we've done here with this shirt on, and really not had that much interest. But we've only had interest from everybody else.
Yeah.
And I've taken players back. Yeah, I've taken players to Watford, to Oxford, I've been all over the place. But you've got to have the interest from people, haven't you?
Yeah.
Before you can do it.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, you've got that interest from, obviously, the parents of the kids, so you've got the kids playing the game, and you'd think that with all the big teams going to America at the moment, so they can create brand awareness, QPR, with you out there, could be you could be like an ambassador for them. You know, you'd think that they would take that opportunity to probably expand the brand QPR, so to speak, and to delve into the American market, because it's obviously, you know, there's a niche there. The MLS is thriving at the moment. They're bringing players like Pirlo and Gerrard, and today I think Drogba signed for a team in Canada, I believe. Was it Montreal Impact? I think he's joined there. So obviously there is a pull, there's a draw there. So I don't see why they're not expanding. I don't understand.
Well, I can't visualize what their theory is. I mean, they just signed a player, I'm trying to think, and that's sounding a little bit rude, the young player's name that they've just signed at the University of South Florida.
Okay.
And don't get me wrong, he's not a bad player, but I put out a tweet, it's out there, some, even before I knew this information, some months ago, that we had the best U-20 striker in America.
Right.
I mean, without a million miles away, he's in Belgium right now, and when you throw that kind of conversation out, you throw it out there because it's what you feel at that moment in time based upon what you've seen playing against FC Dallas, the New England Revolution, Chicago Fire, Columbus Crew, all these development academy teams. And if you feel that you've got a striker that has top quality standards and doesn't want to go the college route, then, somebody has to really be interested, but there's not. But now he, some people have shown some people, it's funny, some of the people get in touch with me via Twitter that I don't even know, I've never met in my life, about my players, and say, well, what do you have? What could we have a look at? What are the chances of we bringing him over? We'll pay for his ticket, we'll house him, we'll look after him, and we'll give him a chance. And that's exactly how all my players have gone into the professional field. Mm-hmm. Apart from my own twins, of course, who they want to do specific things. They want to play in England. They want to do different things and do the best for them. Dependent who's asking at the time for what kind of players we've got. And I don't, when you're talking about football and a team, I don't say, well, these are my kids. I say, these are two players that have a very good chance, and both my kids have far more potential than I ever had in a million years. And that's just a fact. I mean, you've got to know where you were up to at that age. Even though I was playing, one would argue my own boys. I think my boys can play Major League Soccer right now. But that's just an argument based upon some of the standards that I see in Major League Soccer.
Right.
And, yes, it is coming along. And, the great players that are coming here, it's only going to enhance and get better and better and better and better. But that's still years away of trying to have the argument of saying, this team could play in the Premier League, because none of them could play in the Premier League.
Oh, of course. Well, and, you see even in the preseason games that, they're midway or three quarters of the way through their season. The Premier League teams are just warming up at the moment, and the Premier League teams wipe the floor with them. So that just says it all for me.
In general, I mean, the Chelsea thing was kind of very strange, but not seen it all before. The West Brom thing here with Orlando City, and let me get, Adrian Heath's come over here and have done an amazing job, because I think Adrian looks at this and tries to do it in an English way, using different kinds of different people. And he's, what an amazing season he's had already with that group of players that he's got together. But they're both English coaches, and they have different ideas and different ideals. And you've got to hold your hat, take your hat off to Adrian at this moment in time, because he has done really well. But I mean, it's like even with Adrian, it's difficult because they have their academy near ours.
Yeah.
So for them to take a player of mine ahead of their own is a business, if that makes sense as well. And for me, it's not about business. It's about the child. He's either good or he's better. And that's all that matters. But they're just little things that I see. Like the Man United boy wants to play, doesn't want to play for City, just play for United type thing. So, I tried to get US off the floor with QPR. I came back to QPR in 2007 and met with the chair. Eccleston was in charge at the time, and Flavio, and I tried to get the USL franchise off the ground here in Orlando, even before anybody else was even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody's interested in where it is now.
Spot on. Well, David, before I let you go, just a couple of quick questions. Who was your toughest opponent in the game?
Um, you know, in the latter part, obviously, it was really difficult to play against Giggsy now and again. But, you know, when you kind of got the rhythm of what he was doing, it was like you kind of could read it a little bit.
Right. Okay.
You know, it's kind of privileged for him to say in one of his DVDs that, on one of his DVDs, that I was one of the hardest opponents to play against. So I was pleased about that, and like to think that I always give, you know, people a tough time. But if I was really honest, I would say that out of all the people I've ever played against, the hardest one to play against and read was John Robertson.
Right.
You remember him, not Forrest. And, you know, in my early days at Watford, I mean, you know, Robbo had no pace. And, you know, he just didn't know what he was going to do. Is he going to come back? Is he going to check again? Is he going to do it again? And you just couldn't read him. I struggled to really, really against him virtually every time I played against him.
Mm.
And he used to be really good friends, and we used to with a guy that I used to be with in Blackpool and his family. And you know, it was great to sit and talk to him and have a drink, John Robertson, and understand his mentality and his thinking, and you know, how he got the game against quick fullbacks. Or yeah, but he was virtually to play against.
Mm. So these days you've got inverted wingers, don't you? I guess the secret for a fullback, they always said, like, always show him on the outside. But, you know, players like the one you just mentioned, and you know, very difficult to mark, very difficult to stay tight to, you know?
Yeah, I think around the halfway line, you know, you just got to try and shot down the line. And then when they get around the edge of the box, you know, most people will say, well, you got to try and shot him inside. But, you know, doesn't matter who I was playing against, I always knew that I could slide the ball and bring it up. Go straight away with the ball. You know, once you gain people's minds as a fullback, we don't want to play against anyway. Mm. And Mark Walters,
yeah, he was at Liverpool at one point, and Rangers, wasn't he?
Yeah. Wally was really difficult to play against at first, but, you know, when he started knocking the ball down the outside, you kind of just cotton onto it. And, you know, there's an easy way to slide the ball and bring it back out, and they just end up lying on the floor, and you could just break off of the ball and go from there. I enjoyed playing against Lee Sharp. You know, lots of battles there. You know, it's difficult to even think back and remember the top wide players now. I don't even think, you know, Paul Merson at Arsenal wasn't really a wide player as such, but, you know, he was difficult to play against too. And they're always honest, you know. He'd always say to me, "Bart, stop running forward, just stay here." You know, don't go forward anymore.
Fantastic.
You know, yeah. It's the good old days, mate.
Absolutely. Well, look, one more question: if you were FIFA president, what law would you change? If you took over Sepp Blatter's role, what would you change in football?
Difficult question, really, because some of them now are controlling the game. But as you read, obviously, still a lot of naughtiness that's been going on. I don't know. I think that the transfer market and the amount of money that's spent on players is gone. So, and madness to the fact that it's all relative, of course, to, you know, any year in football. But the value depends on players is madness now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, players have got a right to continue to earn as much as they can, but the transfer fees compared to income of the clubs is still madness, in my opinion. I'd have to say, you know, you've got to have some kind of cap on the transfer fees at some stage. You know, it's all a matter of opinion, I guess. But and obviously the transfer window, there should be one a year, in my opinion, and people have got to get on with it from then.
Mm.
It's either that, or you don't have a transfer window at all, and people can do what they want. So I don't really know. These Celtic playing in the Premier League, to see that, of course. You know, so yeah, I'd like to still have another Champions League is the big draw would like to have, you know, see this a great league between certain teams, Premier League teams, you know, that kind of thing. I'd love to see that as well. But a lot of the top teams in Italy are underestimated, of course, underrated.
That's right.
That'd be great to see them. Yeah, spent a lot of time over there. Before Conte left Juventus, went over there, spent some months within this 5-2 system that they play.
Okay.
And we played it in the academy. We played it last year in the academy for the first time, and we made the national final playing that system. And
wow.
You know, America's a big place. We made 6 finals in that year playing that system. And I'm not saying it's the best system in the world. What I'm trying to say is it's really hard to break down if you've got good defenders and people in midfield who don't give the ball away. It's virtually impossible to break down. But there's always, you know, good points and bad points. You know, 4-2-3-1 is still a great formation for me as well. But I learned a lot from those guys over there, and they kind of took me in and took one of my twins as well, and he stayed there. And I don't know what's going to happen with my own boys, but you know, hopefully they'll be able to go on and do much more than I ever did. It's just timing that counts now.
Absolutely. Well, look, David, really appreciate your time. I wish your twins all the best. Have you got any upcoming projects on any websites or your Twitter handle you'd like to mention?
There's not really anything going on at the moment, you know. Doing some work with the U21s here at this moment in time, and most people will know now. You know, I am going to be moving on. Greatly, deeply anticipated to just transition back to London,
okay.
into the academy there. But you know, with the greatest, but I just don't really know what's going on. So you know, I'm going to talk to a couple of major league soccer clubs in the next 2 weeks, and you know, everybody knows me. I'm kind of a QPR person through and through, and if I can't get to do that, then I have to kind of grow a little bit and get on with a job where somebody wants me to do a job for them, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So you know, I'm all about QPR, but I've got a life lead as well.
Fantastic. Well, you're in Florida at the moment, is that right?
Yes, I'm here right now, and I'll be going off to hopefully I've got a fire with one of my twins next week, and Frank Gallup, and see how the guys are doing.
Excellent.
And leave one of my boys. Yeah, so yeah, little bits and pieces going on now, but just kind of finishing off a little bit over here with Paul.
Wonderful. Well, look, if you're still there,
yeah.
If you're still there in September, I'm going to be heading to Florida myself. So I'll give you a shout if you're there.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Hopefully, I won't. Not because you're coming, but hopefully, I will. I will be up and running and doing something slightly different. Hopefully, by then.
Excellent. Well, look, all the best, David. If you want to come back on the show, feel free to, mate. The door's always open for you.
I appreciate it, mate. It's always to talk and, you know.
Brilliant. Well, David, thank you. Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. And we'll speak soon.
All the best. Cheers, I appreciate
mate.
It.
Thank you
so
very
much.
Thank you. Cheers. Take care, Brad. So that, ladies and gents, was David Bardsley. Hope you enjoyed the show. And we'll be back soon. Take care now.